Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Cavanna of the Institute for Policy Studies, who takes a critical look at congressional passage of the Central America Free Trade Agreement and what it may mean for workers on both sides of the border. Tyson Slocum with Public Citizens Energy Program, who discusses the billions of dollars in subsidies and deregulation provisions granted to the energy industry in the recently passed energy bill. And Stanley Aronowitz, professor of sociology and author, who examines the possible consequences of the split within the AFL-CIO and the future of the American labor movement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Violence flared up in late July for the first time in 6 months in the conflict-ridden Darfur region of Sudan. The rebel Sudanese Liberation Movement told the French AFP press agency that 4 villages were bombed by the Sudanese army. In response, an army spokesman said they only attacked rebel camps after a civilian convoy was hit. Meanwhile, Sally Booker, director of the group Africa Action, complained that the U.S. Congress has failed to provide effective action to stop the bloodshed in Darfur since it passed a resolution stating genocide was being committed there. The death of newly appointed Sudanese vice president and former rebel leader John Garang in a helicopter crash in southern Sudan puts the North-South peace process in doubt. In the U.S., anti-genocide activists are putting the heat on American TV networks to increase the amount of coverage to the Darfur crisis, where 2.3 million people were forced from their homes and live in camps for displaced persons and refugees. According to the Tyndall Report, which tracks network news coverage, ABC, CBS, and NBC aired only 26 minutes of coverage of the Darfur crisis in 2004. In contrast, the networks gave the legal troubles of domestic diva Martha Stewart 130 minutes of broadcast news coverage during the same period. The growing wave of violence in Haiti has claimed the life of journalist Jacques Roche. His body was found on July 14th, bound, mutilated, and shot several times. Roche, the cultural editor of Le Martin newspaper, was kidnapped 5 days earlier, and some of his friends had negotiated with his abductors. According to Reuters, more than 450 Haitians have been kidnapped since March, but Roche is only the fourth to be killed. Roche hosted a TV program on civic issues for the Group of 184, the coalition of conservative business, religious, and civic leaders that pushed for the 2004 removal of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. In recent days, police arrested Reverend Gerard Jean-Just, a prominent Aristide supporter, in connection with the killing. The Catholic priest had earlier gone to Roche's funeral, creating a near riot by anti-Aristide forces. Jean-Just was in Florida at the time when the journalist was kidnapped and murdered. Amnesty International has declared Father Jean-Just a prisoner of conscience, arbitrarily arrested by the U.S.-installed government, like dozens of other Aristide supporters in Haiti. Under U.S. pressure, United Nations peacekeepers have increased its presence in neighborhoods loyal to Aristide. On July 6th, U.N. troops raided the Cité Soleil district. The U.N. says 5 people were killed in the raid. Outside observers say dozens were killed. 30 years ago, Pakistani nuclear scientist A.Q. Khan stole vital nuclear secrets while working as a contractor for Urenco, a European-based conglomerate. Over the years, Khan used these stolen secrets to establish Pakistan's nuclear program and developed a black market network for nuclear technology with links to Iran, North Korea, and Libya. Today, Khan remains under house arrest in Pakistan, yet the company Urenco, with the powerful backing of U.S. Senator Peter Domenici of New Mexico, is slated to build a new $1.2 billion uranium enrichment plant in Hobbs, New Mexico. According to Sierra Magazine, its design is similar to the controversial Iranian centrifuge plant. This project also comes at a time when the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is calling for a 5-year moratorium on building new uranium enrichment plants. Yet environmentalists and some local residents are worried about proliferation. Rose Gardner of neighboring Eunice, New Mexico, complained, "Homeland Security is constantly talking to us about being prepared. Be ready. Yet my town is welcoming a company that processes the very technology that the terrorists want." The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which must license the plant, has used security concerns to restrict public access to key sections of the plant's application. Among the related sections, says Don Hancock of the Southwest Research and Information Center, is the possible health hazard of a rail accident involving a shipment of radioactive waste. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino. We'll be right back.
By the narrowest of margins, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Central America Free Trade Agreement in the early hours of July 28th. The hard-fought battle saw last-minute shifts among many legislators whose votes were sought by an aggressive White House wielding threats and rewards. The victory was secured after Republicans extended the usual 15 minutes of voting time to over an hour for the purpose of pressuring wavering representatives. In the end, 15 Democrats supported CAFTA, while 27 Republicans bucked their party by opposing the trade treaty. The controversial Central America Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, will eliminate trade barriers between the U.S., Costa Rica, the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Critics fear that, like the North America Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, that came into force in 1994, CAFTA will accelerate the loss of U.S. jobs, devastate small farmers, and encourage the proliferation of sweatshops. Over the last decade, NAFTA has been blamed for the loss of 1 million American jobs and 1.5 million Mexican farmers being driven off their land. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Cavanna, director of the Institute for Policy Studies. He takes a critical look at congressional passage of the Central America Free Trade Agreement and what it may mean for workers on both sides of the border.
This is another one of these trade agreements that Republicans love and that corporations love. Basically, it's important for your listeners to know these are agreements, even though the title sounds great, free trade, they're basically agreements that give a lot of new rights to large corporations with no new responsibilities. In essence, it allows the Ford Motor Company to shift plants across the border freely. It allows it to shift goods back and forth without paying any tariffs. It gives protections for goods, U.S. goods like cassette CDs, DVDs from being pirated. So it's a whole bunch of protections. It's kind of goodie bag for corporations. And yet, as many of us and many of the critics and trade unions and environmental groups have been saying, it doesn't impose any new responsibilities on these firms to take care of worker rights or pay attention to the environment. What just passed last week is a smaller version of NAFTA. It's a version that will now free up trade and investment and corporate rights between the United States and the countries of Central America and one nation in the Caribbean, the Dominican Republic. Everybody should be clear, this is less of a disaster than NAFTA in that these are small economies. There isn't that much trade and investment between the United States and these countries, although there is some. It's where a lot of textile and apparel companies have gone because of cheap exploited labor, and it's also these are countries that send a lot of sugar into the United States. So there is a fear of job loss, and there is a fear also that there are no environmental protections. One more word. This is why it was only a Pyrrhic victory for the Republicans. They only won it. It was a vote in the House of Representatives. They won it 217 to 215. I actually don't remember a closer vote on any issue. The Bush administration could only pass it, could only win it by buying a number of key votes of Republicans, offering these members deals that would be good for them and their districts at the last minute to buy their votes. So it was only by purchasing democracy, if you will, that they got the thing through.
What do you think this trade agreement means for the people of Central America? Do you expect that we're going to see a lot of maquiladora-type factories opening up or other kinds of economic activity moving north to south?
Yeah, exactly. You already have in countries like El Salvador and Honduras, a lot of sweatshops that make apparel. This will speed it up. This will also speed up the shift of sugar production from sugar beets, which are grown in the U.S., to sugar cane in countries like the Dominican Republic. So it will amount to some job shifting, some job loss, which is going on anyway. It accelerates it. So rather than the U.S. government doing what it should, which is putting in place protections for workers, protections for the environment, disincentives to companies to shift production overseas, they've just passed another set of incentives that are good for corporations and bad for everybody else. I mean, in Central America, George Bush was trying to argue it's great for people in Central America. Well, in fact, these are lousy jobs. These are the same sort of sweatshop jobs that we saw here in the United States 100 years ago, and which aren't good jobs, which don't lead to development, which lead to poverty and immiseration, and go against the struggle for basic rights for all people that are central to the democratic struggles of today.
Now, as we close out here, John, I wanted to ask you about the next fight ahead. As I understand it, the free trade area of the Americas agreement, which is under negotiation, is all but dead, given the many governments that have emerged in Latin America that vehemently oppose the conditions the United States wants to set up in that hemispheric-wide free trade agreement. What do you expect to happen with FTAA and other free trade fights in the near to not too distant future?
There will be now an effort by the United States government to rekindle talks and to negotiate something. And I think given that there is opposition, as you've laid out, in the democracies, the countries that have elected governments skeptical of free trade in Brazil and Argentina and Uruguay and Venezuela, I think what the United States will try to do is pick off other countries and come up with a version of a free trade agreement of the Americas that includes other countries that would be willing to join into the free trade model. This will create a huge fight within Latin America, and there is a certain amount of solidarity among Latin American countries, and I don't think it's going to work. It'll be a big fight, but I think that's winnable. And then the second fight is on the global stage. There is a global NAFTA, if you will, called the World Trade Organization. The U.S. government is trying to give it more powers, strengthen it, enlarge it, give it greater powers to protect corporations. And there will be a big meeting in Hong Kong in December where citizen groups and some developing country governments will band together to try to block that agenda.
That was John Cavanna, director of the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. An industry-friendly energy bill was one of the first pieces of legislation put forward by the Bush administration shortly after taking office in early 2001. But the legislation was mired in controversy as lawsuits by conservative and liberal groups sought access to information about secret meetings to formulate the measure Vice President Dick Cheney had held with executives from the energy industry such as Enron. Every year for the past 4 years, Congress adjourned without passing energy legislation. But just before heading home for this year's August recess, the House and Senate reconciled different versions of the energy bill each chamber had passed in the spring. Opening Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, to oil drilling was not included in the final version of this energy bill, but the Senate had provided such authorization in an unrelated budget bill. So drilling for oil in the Arctic that would at most cover 6 months of U.S. consumption is still on the table. The energy bill gives billions of dollars in subsidies to profitable industries and deregulates the energy industry by repealing one of the strongest consumer and investor protection laws, the Public Utility Holding Company Act. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Tyson Slocum, research director with Public Citizens Energy Program, a consumer advocacy group in Washington, D.C. He assesses the bill and what he views as the measure's few positive provisions, along with its many negative aspects.
The Public Utility Holding Company Act imposes strong regulations over the electric utility industry because it recognizes that electric utility companies in the industry is very unique within the American economy, and so it really needs extra layers of protection for consumers and investors. And what the energy bill does is that it removes these protections. And the first thing that this will result in is a wave of new mergers where lots of other utilities will be acquiring other utilities. But more importantly, different types of companies will now be owning utilities. Now, for the first time, investment banks like Goldman Sachs, insurance companies like John Hancock, and even oil companies like ExxonMobil can now buy utilities, and this will be a very negative thing for consumers because these entities are interested in the guaranteed revenues that electric utilities generate from their captive ratepayers. And so they're going to be more interested in getting their hands on that guaranteed money rather than reinvesting their profits back into reliability and discounts for consumers.
Does the bill make it more or less likely that the U.S. will see another massive blackout such as we had across the East a few years ago?
The energy bill actually does partially address some of the causes of the blackout, and that is the energy bill now will have enforceable mandatory reliability standards where utilities are going to have reliability standards. So in that sense, that's a positive thing, one of the very few positive things in the energy bill. However, the other main contributing factor to the blackout of 2003 was deregulation. In that sense, the energy bill is going to make matters worse because it's going to encourage further deregulation by repealing the Public Utility Holding Company Act, among other things.
How do subsidies for the oil, coal, gas, and nuclear industries in this bill compare with the subsidies for renewable energy?
The energy bill has about $20 billion in tax breaks for energy. 65% of that, or almost $13 billion, is going to oil companies, to coal companies, and for nuclear power. So it's clear that the energy bill is disproportionately benefits dirty and dangerous fuel sources. And that's just ridiculous. You know, ExxonMobil has enjoyed profits of $80 billion since 2001, and yet they and their other oil companies are slated to receive hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in tax breaks. That doesn't make sense from energy policy perspective or from a fiscal policy perspective. The largest five oil companies operating in the United States have enjoyed after-tax profits of $230 billion since 2001. That's because oil prices and gasoline prices are at record highs.
What about nuclear power?
This energy bill greatly escalates the level of subsidies to the nuclear power industry. In fact, it will be providing subsidies at every stage of production. And there's lots of financial incentives to build new nuclear power plants.
And what about renewable energy?
There's about over $3 billion for renewable energy, except some of that renewable energy is going to be included for burning garbage and things like that that aren't really renewable or clean. But it does increase money for wind and solar and hydrogen and other clean renewable energy. It does have some limited energy efficiency measures. It provides some added incentives to homeowners and small businesses to improve the energy efficiency of their homes. And it includes small tax incentives to manufacturers to encourage them to produce more energy efficient appliances like refrigerators and dishwashers and washing machines.
Does the bill include any significant effort to reduce energy consumption?
Every day, the United States uses 25% of the world's oil. But the energy bill does nothing to address rising rates of oil consumption in America. The best way to reduce oil consumption is to improve fuel economy standards in our cars and trucks. But the energy bill, both the House and the Senate, explicitly rejected efforts to improve fuel economy. There is a lot of sensible policies that were rejected during the energy bill debate, and it really comes down to the power of wealthy special interests. That's why we have an energy bill that further deregulates, that'll bring us more Enrons, that will actually contribute to global warming. It will make oil more expensive in this country, and all it does is shower some of the biggest companies in America with huge tax breaks and subsidies.
That was Tyson Slocum of Public Citizens Energy Program. Contact Public Citizen at area code 202-588-1000 or visit their website at www.citizen.org. J. just before July's AFL-CIO National Convention got underway in Chicago, Andy Stern, president of the Service Employees International Union, declared that both the SEIU and Teamsters Union are leaving the nation's primary union federation. The announcement came after 2 years of warnings from Stern and several other union presidents that a split was inevitable unless the AFL-CIO devoted more resources to organizing and undertook other major reforms. The federation's president, John Sweeney, who was a mentor to Stern when both men were at the SEIU, charged that the split was motivated by a power grab rather than substantive divisions over policy. Sweeney warned that the split will undermine labor solidarity when it is needed most to combat the anti-union policies of President Bush and the GOP-controlled Congress. Stern, founder of the new Change to Win Labor Coalition, insists that dramatic restructuring is necessary if unions are to reverse decades of membership losses. Two other large unions may join the SEIU and Teamsters in bolting the AFL-CIO, which could reduce the Federation's 13 million members by up to 5 million. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Stanley Aronowitz, professor of sociology at the City University of New York and author of more than 20 books on labor and economic issues. Aronowitz examines the possible consequences of the split within the AFL-CIO and the future of the American labor movement.
A split right now in the AFL-CIO cannot but help the forward march of the labor movement, if only because competition is really, in many ways, the only way that unions can get off the dime. The AFL-CIO has a bylaw which says that there can be no raiding. It tries to strictly control its member unions in their organizing strategy so that turf wars cannot take place. But in many ways, the unions have always prospered because of chaos. I use the word chaos very deliberately because I think competition, chaos, the unpredictability will help unions. But there are two issues that have to be put into play here. And the first one is that Stern and his colleagues, especially James Hoffa, the president of the Teamsters Union, have said, look, the Sweeney team is really trying to divert a lot of money into politics, that is, to support the Democratic Party. And Hoffa said, don't throw money at the Democrats. Spend the money by giving it to the affiliates and letting them organize the unorganized. And I think that's a very important part of what's going on. I think the Stern team, in this instance, wants to focus on organizing rather than on politics, and especially the politics of a very centrist and a very gloomy Democratic Party, at least on a national scale. The second thing that is very important here, and Robert Fitch has just written a piece that I think is worthy of repeating, he says that the old unions represent the most stable, in many ways, the highest paid of the labor force, public employees, building trades, industrial workers who still have their jobs, who are making decent money, have most of their benefits are still intact. The new groups, with the exception of some sections of the Teamsters, the new groups that want to break away are people who are trying to organize the working poor, are trying to organize people who are not making it, who are working in casual and in many ways substandard jobs with no benefits often and very low wages. So, by and large, the unions are still on a downward spiral, and despite the gains that the service employees have made, I think they still don't have a serious clue as to how to really revive the labor movement.
What about the criticism, Stanley Aronowitz, that in the face of a president who's very hostile towards the labor movement and a House of Representatives and Senate dominated by Republicans with a similar agenda, anti-union agenda, that a split in the AFL-CIO at this time is very dangerous and foolhardy? What do you think?
Well, I don't think that the reasons for the split are necessarily substantial enough to justify it, although I think it might help the unions. The problem with that argument that you just gave me, Scott, is that the unions were declining under the Clinton administration, the unions were declining under the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, Bush 1, and the unions were declining under the Carter administration. The decline is not because of the Bush administration, that is, George W. Bush. The decline is because over the long term, unions have been hit by three major problems. One is globalization. Two is technological change. And three is the internal rot, the bureaucratic rot that most of these unions suffer. They don't have the confidence of their membership. Workers don't think they can be protected in the course of organizing by the unions. The unions don't raise their voices in the ways that they need to raise their voices against the terrible assault on wages and working conditions that large corporations and the government has been undertaking, I think, now for at least 30 years.
Stanley Aronowitz, in your recent article on the future of American labor written before the split occurred within the AFL-CIO, you make the argument that a fire has to be lit under labor across this country to transform it from a mere business unionism to more of something of a vibrant, exciting movement where it's a real cause for people to get involved, and that maybe including hundreds of thousands of people who are not, you know, workplace union members, but maybe involved in unionism and labor as a social change movement.
Unions today cannot transform themselves from within, not only because they lack the vision of what a better life would be, but because they lack the confidence in workers themselves to make the changes that are necessary. I believe that radical forces like the industrial workers of the world, like the communists and the socialists and the other radicals of the 1930s, like the feminists of the 1960s and black freedom movement people, civil rights people who transformed the public employees unions from sleepy time organizations into vibrant large-scale organizations, that we need some kind of movement in some sense that is not within the trade unions themselves to light a fire under the unions and to mobilize people regardless of whether they're going to get a contract or not. I use the example in the article that you refer to of the Trade Union Education League, which was a radical organization in the late 1920s and early 1930s, which really did lit a fire. How it's going to happen, we don't have time to discuss. But I do think that it's not going to happen because Andy Stern or Jim Hoffa or John Sweeney makes pronouncements about the necessity to organize the unorganized.
That was Stanley Aronowitz, professor of sociology at the City University of New York and author of more than 20 books on labor and economic issues. Visit his website at www.stanleyaronowitz.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.